Behind the mountains, half an hour away by wheelchair-ready van, lies the sea. The beaches and bays are not forbidden him. He visited them only 3 months ago. Several friends had to carry him down near the shore and set him in the sand. He sat and stared at the waves, and watched the diving shorebirds, and listened to their spectral complaints. Hours later, when his friends were done swimming and throwing frisbees and chasing each other up and down the sand, he was the only one who hadn't had enough. He turns up the ramp to Memorial Court into the main quad, past Rodin's life-sized Burgers of Calais. The night will be long, and he needs to stock up on snacks to power him through. He motors straight into the inner court, toward the back exit to the Union and all the best vending machines. Lost in his intergalactic plans, he almost mows down a group of Japanese tourists photographing the chapel. Backing away, apologizing, he runs over the toes of an elderly woman on her first trip abroad. She bows, mortified. Nile extricates himself, slams the chair into a hard left, and looks up. There, in a car-sized planter, just to the side of the chapel entrance, bulbous and elephantine, is the most mind-boggling organism he has ever seen. It's the thing he has been searching for his intergalactic opera. A living hallucination from a nearby star system at the other end of a wormhole in space. The groundskeepers must have snuck it in last night under cover of dark. Either that, or he has rolled past it every evening for months without once seeing. He wheels up to the tree and laughs. The trunk looks like a giant upside-down turkey baster. The branches skew and spike out at foolish angles. He reaches out to touch the bark. It's perfect, absurd, up to something. A tiny placard reads, Brachychiton rupestris, Queensland bottle tree. The name excuses nothing and explains even less. It's an alien invader, as surely as Nile. He can't decide which is more incredible, the tree or the fact that he's never noticed it. Shapes flicker on the edge of his vision. Something is happening behind his back. He has the overwhelming feeling of being watched. A silent chorus in his head sings, "Turn and look, turn around and see." He spins the chair in place. Nothing is right. The whole cloister courtyard has changed. One hyper jump, and he has landed in an intergalactic arboretum. On all sides, furious green speculations wave at him, creatures built for otherworldly climates, crazies of every habit and profile, things from epochs so old they make dinosaurs look like upstarts. All these signaling, sentient beings knock him back in his seat. He has never done drugs, but this must be what it's like. Plumes of cream and yellow, a purple waterfall that evaporates before it touches the ground. Trees like freak experiments beckon from out of 8 large planters, each one a miniature starship ark on its way to some other system. Nile sweeps the chair around the courtyard. His paraplegic body tenses as the council shimmers in their standing circle, watching him make the circuit. He rolls past another Susian monster, as alien as the first. He reads the tag. A silk floss tree, from Brazilian forests even now shrinking by 100,000 acres a day. Sharp-tipped, warty cones cover the trunk. Spines that evolved to fend off grazing beasts that went extinct tens of millions of years ago. He rolls from planter to planter, touching the beings, smelling them, listening to their rustles. They have come from hot islands and desiccated outback, from remote valleys in Central Asia, breached only recently. Dove tree, jacaranda, desert spoon, camphor tree, flame tree, empress tree, currajong, red mulberry. unearthly life, waiting to waylay him in this courtyard while he was searching for them on distant planets. He touches their bark and feels just beneath their skins the teeming assemblies of cells, like whole planetary civilizations, pulse and hum. The Japanese tourists disappear back to their bus on Galvez. Nile holds still in the emptied space, like a rabbit evading a raptor. He's alone for no more than a few seconds, but in that interval, the alien invaders insert a thought directly into his limbic system. There will be a game, a billion times richer than anything yet made, to be played by countless people around the world at the same time. And Nile must bring it into being. He'll unfold the creation in gradual evolutionary stages over the course of decades. The game will put its players smack in the middle of a living, breathing, seething, animist world filled with millions of different species, a world desperately in need of the player's help. And the goal of the game will be to figure out what the new and desperate world wants from you. The vision ends, depositing him again in Stanford's inner quad. The vision, religious and dark green, fades back into its platonic shadow. Wood. Nile holds still, clinging to what he has just seen, the thing his brain has somehow apprehended, lurking out at the end of the curve of Moore's Law. He'll have to drop out of school. No time for more classes now. He must pace himself for the long run. He'll finish the quaint little role-playing space opera he's working on, then put it up for sale. Real money, Earth dollars. His fans will howl. They'll smear him on the country's dial-up bulletin boards as the worst traitor. But at $15 for 30 parsecs, the game will be a steal. The profits from his first foray into alien life will pay for the sequel. A game to surpass the original in ambition many times over. And by such small steps, he'll get to the place he has just seen. He rolls out of the cloister just as the light vanishes behind the mountains. The hills cast a shadow on themselves, bruise blue turning to forgetful black. High up, beyond his sight, rocky outcrops crawl with manzanita, shedding their curling crimson barks. Bay laurels rim the logger-made meadows, canyons thick with orange madrona peeling to creamy, clammy green. Coast live oaks, like the one that crippled him, gather on the crags. And down in cool riparian corridors smelling of silt and decaying needles, redwoods work a plan that will take 1,000 years to realize. The plan that now uses him, although he thinks it's his. Patricia Westerford. It's 1950, and like the boy Sipparissus, whom she'll soon discover, little Patty Westerford falls in love with her pet deer. Hers is made of twigs, though it's every bit alive. Also, squirrels, from pairs of glued walnut shells, bears made of sweet gum balls, dragons from the pods of Kentucky coffee trees, fairies donning acorn caps, and an angel whose pine cone body needs only 2 holly leaves for wings. She builds these creatures elaborate homes with pebbled front walks and mushroom furniture. She sleeps them in beds fitted with magnolia petal comforters. She watches over them, the guiding spirit of a kingdom whose towns nestle behind closed doors in the burls of trees. Knotholes turn into louvered windows, through which, squinting, she can see the inviting parlors of woody citizens, the lost kin of humans. She lives there, with her creatures, in the minuscule architecture of imagination, so much richer than the offerings of full-sized life. When her tiny wooden doll's head twists off, She plants it in the garden, certain it will grow another body. All her twig creatures can talk, though most, like Patty, have no need of words. She herself said nothing until past the age of 3. Her 2 older brothers interpreted her secret language for their frightened parents, who began to think she must be mentally deficient. They brought Patty into the clinic in Chillicothe for tests that revealed a deformation of the inner ear. The clinic fitted her with fist-sized hearing aids, which she hated. When her own speech started to flow at last, it hid her thoughts behind a slurry hard for the uninitiated to comprehend. It didn't help that her face was sloped and ursine. The neighbors' kids ran from her, this thing only borderline human. Acorn people are so much more forgiving. Her father alone understands her woodlands world, as he always understands her every thickened word. She has a pride of place with him that the 2 boys accept. With them, Dad may throw softballs and tell bubblegum wrapper jokes and play tag, but he reserves his best gifts for his little plant girl, Patty. Their closeness bothers her mother. I ask you, has there ever been such a little nation of 2? Bill Westerford takes Patricia with him when he visits southwestern Ohio farms on his tours as an ag extension agent. She rides co-pilot in the beaten-up Packard with the pine side paneling. The war is over. The world is on the mend. The country is drunk on science, key to better living, and Bill Westerford takes his daughter out to see the world. Patty's mother objects to the trips. The girl should be in school, but her father's soft authority prevails. She won't learn more anywhere than she will with me. Mile after plowed mile, they hold their roving tutorial. He faces her so she can read his moving lips. She laughs at his stories, thick, slow booms, and stabs enthusiastic answers to each of his questions. Which is more numerous, the stars in the Milky Way or the chloroplasts on a single leaf of corn? Which trees flower before they leaf and which flower after? Why are the leaves at the top of trees often smaller than those at the bottom? If you carved your name 4 feet high in the bark of a beech tree, how high would it be after half a century? She loves the answer to that last one. 4 feet. Still 4 feet. Always 4 feet, however high the beech tree grows. She'll love that answer still, half a century later. In this way, acorn animism turns bit by bit into its offspring, botany. She becomes her father's star and only pupil, for the simple reason that she alone, of all the family, sees what he knows. Plants are willful and crafty and after something, just like people. He tells her on their drives about all the oblique miracles that green can devise. People have no corner on curious behavior. Other creatures, bigger, slower, older, more durable, call the shots, make the weather, feed creation, and create the very air. It's a great idea, trees. So great that evolution keeps inventing it again and again. He teaches her to tell a shellbark from a shagbark hickory. No one else at her school can even tell a hickory from a hop hornbeam. The fact strikes her as bizarre. Kids in my class think a black walnut looks just like a white ash. Are they blind? Plant blind. Adam's curse. We only see things that look like us. Sad story, ain't it, kiddo? Her father has a little trouble with Homo sapiens himself. He's caught between fine folks whose family farms are failing to subdue the earth and companies that want to sell them the arsenal to bring about total dominion. When the frustrations of the day grow too much for him, he sighs and says, for Patty's impaired ears alone, "Ah, buy me a hillside that slopes away from town." They drive through a land once covered in dark beech forest. Best tree you could ever want to see. Strong and wide, but full of grace, flaring out nobly at the base into its own plinth, generous with nuts that feed all comers. Its smooth, white-gray trunk, more like stone than wood. The parchment-colored leaves, riding out the winter, marcescent, he tells her, shining out against the neighboring bare hardwoods. Elegant with sturdy boughs so much like human arms, lifting upward at the tips like hands proffering. Hazy and pale in spring, but in autumn its flat, wide sprays bathe the air in gold. "What happened to them?" The girl's words thicken when sadness weighs them down. "We did." She thinks she hears her father sigh, though he never takes his eyes off the road. "The beech told the farmer where to plow, limestone underneath, covered in the best, darkest loam a field could want." They drive from farm to farm, between last year's blights and next year's vanishing topsoil. He shows her extraordinary things. The spreading cambium of a sycamore that swallowed up the crossbar of an old schwinn someone left leaning against it decades ago. Two elms that draped their arms around each other and became one tree. "We know so little about how trees grow. Almost nothing about how they bloom and branch and shed and heal themselves. We've learned a little about a few of them in isolation. But nothing is less isolated or more social than a tree. Her father is her water, air, earth, and sun. He teaches her how to see a tree, the living sheath of cells underneath every square inch of bark, doing things no man has yet figured out. He drives them to a copse of spared hardwoods in the bottoms of a slow stream. "Here, look at this, look at this!" A patchwork of narrow stalks, each with big, drooping leaves. A sheepdog of trees. He makes her sniff the giant spoon-like foliage, crushed. It smells acrid, like blacktop. He picks up a thick yellow pickle from the ground and holds it to her. She has rarely seen him so excited. He takes his army knife and cuts the fruit in half, exposing the buttery pulp and shiny black seeds. The flesh makes her want to scream with pleasure, but her mouth is full of butterscotch pudding. "Pawpaw, the only tropical fruit ever to escape the tropics. Biggest, best, weirdest, wildest native fruit this continent ever made. Growing native, right here in Ohio. And nobody knows." They know, the girl and her father. She'll never tell anyone the location of this patch. It will be theirs alone, fall after prairie banana fall. Watching the man, hard of hearing, hard of speech, Patty learns that real joy consists of knowing that human wisdom counts less than the shimmer of beeches in a breeze. As certain as weather coming from the west, the things people know for sure will change. There is no knowing for a fact. The only dependable things are humility and looking. He finds her out in the backyard, making birds from the twinned wings of maple samaras. An odd look comes over his face. He holds up one of the seeds and points it toward the giant that shed it. "Have you noticed how it releases more seeds in updrafts than when the wind is blowing downward? Why is that?" These questions are her favorite thing in the world. She thinks.
"Travels, father?"
He puts his finger to his nose. "Bingo!" He looks at the tree and frowns, working through old puzzlements all over again. "Where do you think all the wood comes from to get from this little thing to that? Wild guess.
The dirt?
How could we find out? They design the experiment together. They put 200 pounds of soil in a wooden tub by the south face of the barn. Then they extract a three-angled beech nut from its cupule, weigh it, and push it into the loam. If you see a trunk carved full of letters, it's a beech. People can't help writing all over that smooth gray surface. God love 'em. They want to watch their lettered hearts growing bigger year after year. Fond lovers, cruel as their flame, cut in these trees their mistress' name. Little, alas, they know or heed how far these beauties hers exceed. He tells her how the word beech becomes the word book in language after language. How book branched up out of beech roots way back in the parent tongue. How beech bark played host to the earliest Sanskrit letters. Patty pictures their tiny seed growing up to be covered with words. But where will the mass of such a massive book come from? We'll keep the tub moist and free of weeds for the next 6 years. When you turn sweet 16, we'll weigh the tree and the soil again. She hears him and understands. This is science, and worth a million times more than anything any person might ever swear to you. In time, she gets almost as good as her father at telling what's wilting or gnawing on a farmer's crops. He stops quizzing her and starts consulting. Not in front of the farmers, of course, but later, back in the car, when they have the luxury of thinking through the infestations as a team. On her 14th birthday, he gives her a Baudelaireized translation of Ovid's Metamorphosis. It's inscribed, "For my dear daughter, who knows how big and wide the family tree really is." Patricia opens the book to the first sentence and reads, "Let me sing to you now about how people turn into other things." At those words, she's back where acorns are a step away from faces and pine cones compose the bodies of angels. She reads the book. The stories are odd and fluid, as old as humankind. They're somehow familiar, as if she were born knowing them. The fables seem to be less about people turning into other living things than about other living things somehow reabsorbing, at the moment of greatest danger, the wildness inside people that never really went away. By now, Patricia's body is well along its own tortured metamorphosis into something she in no way wants. The new flare to her chest and hips, the start of a patch between her legs, turns her, too, halfway into a more ancient beast. She loves best the stories where people change into trees. Daphne, transformed into a bay laurel just before Apollo can catch and harm her. The women killers of Orpheus, held fast by the earth, watching their toes turn into roots and their legs into woody trunks. She reads of the boy Cyparissus, whom Apollo converts into a cypress so that he might grieve forever for his slain pet deer. The girl turns beet cherry apple red at the story of Mira, changed into a myrtle after creeping into her father's bed. And she cries at that steadfast couple, Baucis and Philemon, spending the centuries together as oak and linden, their reward for taking in strangers who turned out to be gods. Her 15th autumn comes. The days shorten. Night falls early, signaling the trees to drop their sugar-making project, shed all vulnerable parts, and harden up. Sap falls. Cells become permeable. Water flows out of the trunks and concentrates into antifreeze. The dormant life just below the bark is lined with water so pure that nothing is left to help it crystallize. Her father explains how the trick is done. Think about it. They've figured out how to live trapped in place, with no other protection, whipped by winds at 30 below zero. Later that winter, Bill Westerford is coming home from a field trip after sundown, when the Packard hits a patch of black ice. He's thrown from the car as it flips off the road into a ditch. His body flies for 25 feet before crashing into a row of Osage orange that farmers planted for a hedge a century and a half earlier. At the funeral, Patty reads from Ovid, the promotion of Baucis and Philemon to trees. Her brothers think she has lost her mind with grief. She won't let her mother throw anything out. She keeps his walking stick and pork pie hat in a kind of shrine. She preserves his precious library, Aldo Leopard, John Muir, his botany texts, the Ag Extension pamphlets he helped to write. She finds his copy of Adult Ovid, marked all over as people mark beaches. The underscores start, triple, on the very first line. Let me sing to you now about how people turn into other things. High school tries to kill her. Viola in the orchestra, the maple howling with old hillside memories under her chin. Photography and volleyball. She has two almost friends who understand the reality of animals, at least, if not quite plants. She shuns all jewelry, dresses in flannel and denim, carries a Swiss Army knife, and wears her long hair wrapped around her skull in braids. A stepfather arrives, one who's smart enough not to try to reform her. There's a trauma involving a quiet boy who dreams for 2 years of taking her to the senior prom, a boy whose dream must die from a white oak stake through the heart. In the summer of her 18th year, preparing to head to eastern Kentucky to study botany, she remembers the beech growing in its tub of soil out by the barn. Shame rushes through her. How could she have forgotten the experiment? She has missed her promise to her father by 2 years, skipped Sweet 16 altogether. She spends an entire July afternoon freeing the tree from the soil and crumbling every thimble of dirt from its roots. Then she weighs both the plant and the earth it fed on. The fraction of an ounce of beechnut now weighs more than she does, but the soil weighs just what it did minus an ounce or two. There's no other explanation. Almost all the tree's mass has come from the very air. Her father knew this. Now she does, too. She replants their experiment in a spot behind the house where she and her father liked to sit on summer nights and listen to what other people called silence. She remembers what he told her about the species. People, God love 'em, must write all over beaches. But some people, some fathers, are written all over by trees. Before she goes away to school, she puts the tiniest notch in the smooth, gray, book-like bark of the trunk with her army knife, 4 feet above the ground. Eastern Kentucky University turns her into someone else. Patricia blooms like something southern-facing. The air of the 60s crackles as she crosses campus. A change in the weather, the smell of days lengthening, the scent of possibility breaking the cast of outdated thought, a clear wind rolling down from the hills. Her dorm room overflows with potted plants. She's not the only one on her floor to fit a botanical garden between the student desk and bunk bed. But her plants are the only ones with strips of data taped to their terracotta pots. where her friends grow baby's breath and blue-eyed violets, she grows tick seed and partridge pea and other experiments. And yet, she also cares for a bonsai juniper that looks to be 1,000 years old, a spiky haiku of a creature with no scientific purpose whatsoever. The girls from upstairs come down some nights to check on her. They've made her into a pet project.
Let's get Plant Patty drunk. Let's fix Plant Patty up with that beatnik econ guy.
They mock her studiousness and laugh at her calling. They force her to listen to Elvis. They slip her into sleeveless sheaths and pile up her hair in a bouffant. They call her the Queen of Chlorophyll. She's not of the herd. She doesn't always hear them well, and when she does, their words don't always make sense. And yet her frantic fellow mammals do make her smile. Miracles on all sides, and still they need compliments to keep them happy. Sophomore year, Patty gets a job in the campus greenhouses. 2 hours stolen every morning before classes. Genetics, plant physiology, and organic chemistry take her through evening. She studies every night at her carrel until the library closes. Then she reads for pleasure until she falls asleep. She does try the books her friends are reading. Siddhartha, Naked Lunch, On the Road. But nothing else moves her more than Petey's Natural Histories, books from her father's shelves. Now they're her endless refreshment. Their phrases branch and turn to catch the sun. Thrones have crumbled and new empires arisen. Great ideas have been born and great pictures painted, and the world revolutionized by science and invention. And still, no man can say how many centuries this oak will endure, or what nations and creeds it may outlive. Where the deer bound, where the trout rise, where your horse stops to slather a drink from icy water while the sun is warm on the back of your neck, where every breath you draw is exhilaration, that is where the aspens grow. And of her father's beloved tree, let other trees do the work of the world. Let the beech stand where still it holds its ground. She never exactly becomes a swan, yet the senior who emerges out of freshman ugly ducklinghood knows what she loves and how she intends to spend her life. And that's a novelty among the youth of any year. Those she doesn't scare away come sniff her out, this keen, homely, forthright girl who has escaped the stoop of constant social compliance. To her astonishment, she even has suitors. Something about her perks boys up. Not her looks, of course, but an ever-so-slightly head-turning quality to her walk that they can't quite place. Independent thought, a power of attraction all its own. When boys come calling, she makes them take her for a picnic lunch in Richmond Cemetery, serving the needs of dead people since 1848. Sometimes they flee, and that's that. If they stick around and mention the trees, she'll see them again. Desire, she scribbles into her field notebooks, turns out to be infinitely varied, the sweetest of evolution's tricks. And in the pollen storms of spring, even she turns out to be a more than adequate flower. One boy sticks around, month after month. Andy, the English major. He plays in the orchestra with her, and loves Hart Crane, and O'Neill, and Moby Dick, although he can't say why. He can get birds to land on his shoulder. He's waiting for something to come and redeem his aimless life. One night over cribbage, he says he thinks it might be her. She takes him by the hand and leads him to her narrow bed. Clumsy and green, they peel back the shields of clothing. 10 minutes later, she's turned into a tree just a little too late to be spared. Real life starts in graduate school. There are mornings in West Lafayette when Patricia Westerford's luck scares her. Forestry school. She feels unworthy. Purdue pays her to take classes that she has craved for years. She gets food and lodging for teaching undergraduate botany, something she'd gladly pay to do, and her research demands long days in the Indiana woods. It's an animist's heaven. But by her second year, the catch becomes clear. In a seminar on forest management, the professor declares that snags and windthrow should be cleaned up from the forest floor and pulped to improve forest health. That doesn't seem right. A healthy forest must need dead trees. They've been around since the beginning. Birds turn them to use, and small mammals, and more forms of insects lodge and dine on them than science has ever counted. She wants to raise her hand and say, like Ovid, how all life is turning into other things. But she doesn't have the data. All she has is the intuition of a girl who grew up playing in the forest litter. Soon, she sees. Something is wrong with the entire field, not just at Purdue, but nationwide. The men in charge of American forestry dream of turning out straight, clean, uniform grains at maximum speed. They speak of thrifty young forests and decadent old ones, of mean annual increment and economic maturity. She's sure these men who run the field will have to fall next year or the year after, and up from the downed trunks of their beliefs will spring rich new undergrowth. That's where she'll thrive. She preaches this covert revolution to her undergrads.
You'll look back in 20 years, amazed at what every smart person in forestry took to be self-evident truth. It's the refrain of all good science. How could we not have seen?
She works well with her fellow grads. She goes to the barbecues and hootenannies and manages to take part in departmental gossip while remaining her own little sovereign state. One night, there's a dizzy, warm, wild misunderstanding with a woman in plant genetics. Patricia puts the embarrassed fumble away in a drawer of her heart and never takes it out again, even to look at. A secret suspicion sets her apart from the others. She's sure, on no evidence whatsoever, that trees are social creatures. It's obvious to her. Motionless things that grow in mass mixed communities must have evolved ways to synchronize with one another. Nature knows few loner trees, but the belief leaves her marooned. Bitter irony. Here she is, with her people at last, and even they can't see the obvious. Purdue gets hold of one of the first prototype quadrupole gas chromatography mass spectrometers. Some pagan god brings the machine right to Patricia as a reward for her constancy. With such a device, she can measure which volatile organic compounds the grand old eastern trees put into the air, and what these gases do to the neighbors. She pitches the idea to her advisor. People know nothing about the stuff trees make. It's a whole new green world, ripe for discovery. How will that produce anything useful?
It might not.
Why do you need to do this in a forest? Why not the campus test plots?
You wouldn't study wild animals by going to the zoo.
You think cultivated trees behave differently than trees in a forest? She's sure of it. But his sigh is as clear as a public service announcement. Girls doing science are like bears riding bikes. Possible, but freakish. I'll reserve some trees in the woodlot. It'll make things easier and save you lots of time.
There's no hurry. Your dissertation, your time to waste.
She wastes it with the most intense pleasure. The work isn't glamorous. It consists of taping numbered plastic bags over the ends of branches, then collecting them at measured intervals. She does this over and over, dumbly and mutely, hour by hour, while the world around her rages with assassination, race riot, and jungle warfare. She works all day in the woods, her back crawling with chiggers, her scalp with ticks, her mouth filled with leaf duff, her eyes with pollen, cobwebs like scarves around her face, bracelets of poison ivy, her knees gouged by cinders, her nose lined with spores, the backs of her thighs bitten braille by wasps, and her heart as happy as the day is generous. She brings the collected samples back into the lab and spends hour after tedious hour puzzling out the concentrations and molecular weights, determining which gases each of her trees breathed out. There must be thousands of compounds, tens of thousands. The tedium makes her ecstatic. She calls it the science paradox. It's the most brain-crushing work a person can do. Yet it can spring the mind enough to see what else but the mind is really out there. And she gets to work in the dappling sun and rain, the stink of humus filling up her nose with relentlessly musky life. Out in the woods, her father is with her again, all day long. She asks him things, and the mere act of asking out loud helps her see. What starts a shelf fungus growing at just a certain height up a trunk? How many square meters of solar panel does a given tree put out? Why should there be such tremendous difference in size between the leaf of a serviceberry and that of a sycamore? It's a miracle, she tells her students, photosynthesis, a feat of chemical engineering underpinning creation's entire cathedral. All the razzmatazz of life on Earth is a free rider on that mind-boggling magic act. The secret of life. Plants eat light and air and water, and the stored energy goes on to make and do all things. She leads her charges into the inner sanctum of the mystery. Hundreds of chlorophyll molecules assemble into antennae complexes. Countless such antennae arrays form up into thylakoid discs. Stacks of these discs align in a single chloroplast. Up to 100 such solar power factories power a single plant cell. Millions of cells may shape a single leaf. A million leaves rustle in a single glorious ginkgo. Too many zeros, their eyes glaze over. She must shepherd them back over that ultra-fine line between numbness and awe. Billions of years ago, a single, fluke, self-copying cell learned how to turn a barren ball of poison gas and volcanic slag into this peopled garden. And everything you hope, fear, and love became possible. They think she's nuts, and that's fine with her. She's content to post a memory forward to their distant futures, futures that will depend on the inscrutable generosity of green things. Late at night, too tired from teaching and research to work more, she reads her beloved Muir. A 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf, and My First Summer in the Sierra, float her soul up to her room's ceiling and spin it like a Sufi. She writes her favorite lines in the inside covers of her field notebooks and peeks at them when department politics and the cruelty of frightened humans get her down. The words withstand the full brutality of day. We all travel the Milky Way together, trees and men. In every walk with nature, one receives far more than he seeks.
the clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness.
Plant Patty becomes Dr. Pat Westerford, a way to disguise her gender in professional correspondence. Her work on tulip trees earns her a doctorate. It turns out that those thick, long lengths of culvert pipe stood on end are factories richer than anyone suspects. Liriodendron has a repertoire of scents. It breathes out volatile organic compounds that do all kinds of things. She doesn't yet know how the system works. She just knows it's rich and beautiful. She lands a postdoc at Wisconsin. She searches Madison for relics of Aldo Leopold. She looks for the towering black locust, with its fragrant racemes and peapod seeds, the tree that stunned Muir into becoming a naturalist. But the world-changing locust was cut down 12 years before. The postdoc turns into an adjunct position. She makes almost nothing, but life requires little. Her budget is blessedly free of those two core expenses, entertainment and status. And the woods teem with free food. She starts to examine sugar maples in a forest east of town. Her breakthrough comes, as breakthroughs often do, by long and prepared accident. Patricia arrives in her copse on a balmy day in June to find one of her bagged trees under full-scale insect invasion. At first it seems that the last several days of data are ruined. Improvising, she keeps the samples from the damaged tree, as well as several nearby maples. Back in the lab, she widens the list of compounds she looks at. Over the next few weeks, she finds something that even she isn't ready to believe. Another nearby tree gets infested. She measures again. Again, she doubts the evidence. Fall begins, and the leaves of her complex chemical factories shudder and drop to the forest floor. She battens down for the winter, teaching, double-checking her results, trying to accept their crazy implications. She wanders the woods, wondering if she should publish or run the experiment for another year. The oaks in her forest shine scarlet still, the beeches a stunning bronze. It seems wise to wait. Confirmation comes the following spring. 3 more trials, and she's convinced. The trees under attack pump out insecticides to save their lives. That much is uncontroversial, but something else in the data makes her flesh pucker. Trees a little way off, untouched by the invading swarms, ramp up their own defenses when their neighbor is attacked. Something alerts them. They get wind of the disaster, and they prepare. She controls for everything she can, and the results are always the same. Only one conclusion makes any sense. The wounded trees send out alarms that other trees smell. Her maples are signaling. They're linked together in an airborne network, sharing an immune system across acres of woodland. These brainless, stationary trunks are protecting each other. She can't quite let herself believe, but the data keep confirming. And on that evening when Patricia finally accepts what the measurements say, her limbs heat up and tears run down her face. For all she knows, she's the first creature in the expanding adventure of life who has ever glimpsed this small but certain thing that evolution is up to. Life is talking to itself, and she has listened in. She writes up the results as soberly as she can. Her report is all chemistry, concentrations, and rates, nothing but what the gas chromatography equipment records. But in her paper's conclusion, she can't resist suggesting what the results spell out. The biochemical behavior of individual trees may make sense
only when we see them as members of a community.
Dr. Pat Westerford's paper gets accepted by a reputable journal. The peer reviewers raise their eyebrows, but her data are sound and no one can find any problems except common sense. On the day the article appears, Patricia feels she has discharged her debt to the world. If she dies tomorrow, she'll still have added this one small thing to what life has come to know about itself. The press picks up on her findings. She does an interview for a popular science magazine. She struggles to hear the questions over the phone and stumbles with her answers. But the piece runs, and other newspapers pick it up. Trees talk to one another. She gets a few letters from researchers across the country asking for details. She's invited to speak at the Midwestern branch meeting of the Professional Forestry Society. 4 months later, the journal that ran the piece prints a letter signed by three leading dendrologists. The men say her methods are flawed and her statistics problematic. The defenses of the intact trees could have been activated by other mechanisms. Or these trees might already have been compromised by insects in ways she didn't notice. The letter mocks the idea that trees send each other chemical warnings. Patricia Westerford displays an almost embarrassing misunderstanding of the units of natural selection. Even if a message is in some way received, it would in no way imply that any such message has been sent. The short letter contains four uses of the word Patricia and no mention of Doctor until their own signatures. Two Yale professors and a named chair at Northwestern versus an unknown adjunct girl at Madison. No one in the profession bothers trying to replicate Patricia Westerford's findings. Those researchers who wrote her for more information stop responding to her letters. The newspapers that ran the wide-eyed articles follow up with accounts of her brutal debunking. Patricia goes through with her scheduled talk at the Midwestern Forestry Conference in Columbus. The room is small and hot. Her hearing aids howl with feedback. Her slides jam in the carousel. The questions are hostile. Fielding them from behind the podium, Patricia feels her old childhood speech defect returning to punish her for her hubris. For the three agonizing days of the conference, people nudge each other as she passes them in the halls of the hotel. There's the woman who thinks that trees are intelligent. Madison doesn't renew her lectureship. She scrambles to line up a job elsewhere, but it's too late in the season. She can't even get work washing glassware for some other researcher. No other animal closes ranks faster than Homo sapiens. Without a lab to use, she can't vindicate herself. At 32, she starts substitute teaching in high schools. Friends in the field murmur in sympathy, but none goes public to defend her. Meaning drains from her like green from a maple in fall. After long weeks in solitude replaying what happened, she decides it's time to shed. She's too cowardly to give in to the scenarios that play in her head most nights as she tries to fall asleep. The pain prevents her. Not hers, the pain she'd inflict on her mother and brothers and remaining friends. Only the woods protect her from undying shame. She tramps the winter trails, feeling the thick, sticky horse chestnut buds with her frozen fingers. The understory fills up with tracks, like longhand accusations scribbled on the snow. She listens to the forest, to the chatter that has always sustained her, but all she can hear is the deafening wisdom of crowds. Half a year passes at the bottom of a well. One bright blue, crisp Sunday morning in high summer, Patricia finds several unexpanded caps of Amanita bisporigera under a stand of oak in the bottomlands of Token Creek. The fungi are beautiful,
but take forms that would make the old doctrine of signatures blush. She gathers them in her mushroom bag and brings them home. There she cooks up a Sunday feast for one. Chicken tenderloins, in butter, olive oil, garlic, shallots, and white wine, all seasoned with just enough destroying angel to shut down both her kidneys and her liver. She sets the table and sits down to a meal that smells like health itself. The beauty of the plan is that no one will know. Every year, amateur mycologists mistake young A. bisporigera for Agaricus silvicola, or even Volvariella vulvacea. Neither her friends, nor family, nor former colleagues will think anything but this. She was wrong in her controversial research, and wrong in her choice of fungal fruiting bodies for her dinner. She brings the steaming forkful to her lips. Something stops her. Signals flood her muscles, finer than any words. Not this. Come with. Fear nothing. The fork drops back to the plate. She rouses as from sleepwalking. Fork, plate, mushroom feast. Everything turns as she watches into a fit of madness, lifted. In another heartbeat, she can't believe what her animal fear was willing to make her do. The opinion of others left her ready to suffer the most agonizing of deaths. She runs the entire meal down the garbage disposal and goes hungry, a hunger more wonderful than any meal. Her real life starts this night, a long post-mortem bonus round. Nothing in the years to come can do worse than she was ready to do to herself. Human estimation can no longer touch her. She's free now to experiment, to discover anything. Then, several missing years. From the outside, yes. Patricia Westerford disappears into underemployment. Sorting storeroom boxes, cleaning floors, odd jobs leading from the upper Midwest through the Great Plains toward the high mountains. She has no affiliation, no access to equipment, nor does she try for lab positions or teaching stints, even when former colleagues encourage her to apply. Pretty much all her old friends add her to the roster of science roadkill. In fact, she's busy learning a foreign language. With few claims on her time and none on her soul, she turns back outside, into the woods, the green negation of all careers. She no longer theorizes or speculates, just watches, notes, and sketches into a stack of notebooks, her only persistent possessions, aside from clothes. Her eyes go near and narrow. She camps out many nights with Muir, under the spruce and fir, completely lost, turned wildly around by the smell of inland oceans, sleeping on beds of thick lichen, 16 inches of brown needle pillow, the living earth beneath her bag, its fluid influence rising up into the fiber of her and all the towering trunks that surround and watch over. The particle of her private self rejoins everything it has been split off from. The plan of runaway green. I only went out for a walk, and finally concluded to stay out till sundown, for going out, I found, was really going in. She reads Thoreau over wood fires at night. Shall I not have intelligence with the earth? Am I not partly leaves and vegetable mold myself? And what is this Titan that has possession of me, talk of mysteries, think of our life in nature, daily to be shown matter, to come in contact with it, rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world, the common sense, contact, contact. Who are we? Where are we?
Now she drifts farther west. It's amazing how far a little war chest will go once you learn how to forage. This country is awash in food free for the eating.